that is funny, not only because of his Jackie Gleason-style delivery, but because of its inappropriateness in a situation where we're probably all going to die. About 30 minutes later, Dan Dan the Death Man comes back on, saying that thanks to the excellent work of the firefighters on the crew, the fire is out. We will be able to return to our cabins as soon as the rest of the ship has been checked. He says that the heat from the fire set off every alarm on the ship, and so every chamber must be checked before we can go back inside. Most people take this as good news, but I'm too smart for that. I know that extreme heat plus a burst fuel pipe means that the ship is going to explode now. While people around me start to relax, I keep my eyes on the sea, waiting to be rocketed into it in a wave of fire. I'll be ready for it to happen, and that way it won't happen. It's a burden, being able to control situations with my hypervigilance, but it's my lot in life. Some crew members come around with coolers of cold drinks. A nearby woman takes a soda and hands it back, saying, "Do you have diet?" If God had a sense of humor, the ship would have exploded right then. Actually, I think God does have a sense of humor, as evidenced by squirrels eating pizza with their hands and that thing where suicide bombers accidentally detonate before they get to their destination. The ship does not explode. After an hour or so, we are allowed into the lounge where they give out playing cards. People are sleeping on the floor. It's very Poseidon Adventure. It's almost 3 a.m. when we return to our cabin. Our sunglasses are just sitting there on the bed. Whatever towel animal that was wearing them has fled in terror. We sleep in our clothes. In the morning, my husband, who, for legal reasons, I will now call Lee, wakes me up and says that we've turned back to Bermuda. This is one of the things I love about Lee, that he is manly and old-fashioned enough to know that the sun should be on our right if we're headed north. They must be taking us back to Bermuda and flying us home. Lee's face shrinks with worry. I think about our table mates who had mentioned they also don't like to fly. Most of the people on this ship are afraid to fly. My God, that's why they're here. Cruising itself is not actually fun. I spring into action. There must be a finite amount of anti-anxiety medication on this ship. While most people are still asleep, I find the infirmary and procure two pills for my husband. One for when the plane takes off, and one for when I tell him he's right, we're being sent home on a plane. After handing the first pill to my husband, Rod, Jeff's complaining that Lee sounds too feminine. Damn it, I used his real name again. I head to the business center and make a $40 ship-to-shore call to let my parents know that in spite of what they may have seen on the news, we are okay. I'm surprised to learn that this was not a news story. The crew tries to downplay the seriousness of the night before. The midnight cooking demonstration canceled last night is now being held in the hot sunlight. The guys are back playing the steel drums by the pool bar, but now the music seems creepy, like when children sing in a horror movie, or when guys play steel drums on a cruise ship that almost sank. The crew is glum. The scuttlebutt, which actually is scuttlebutt and not gossip because we're on a ship, is that the ship is being taken back to Bermuda, where it will be dry docked and repaired for 6 months. No wonder they're a little half-hearted about the cooking demonstration. They're all out of a job. I buy our formal night picture from the photo center. That I actually pay for it instead of just taking it after all this nonsense is a credit to my parents. Rod and I are looking tan and grinning at the lady pirate between us. What amount of revisionism will be necessary for this photo to be an accurate memento of our trip? I run into Betty, Bernie, Barbara, and Richard in the cafeteria. Betty and Bernie have officially given up on Bermuda. Richard is ashen. I can tell he's the one who's terrified to fly. "Did you get some pills?" I asked. "They were out," his wife answers. As the ship pulls back into King's Wharf, local women and children are cheering us in. Little topless boys are waving their T-shirts in the air. Nothing gives you a fear flashback like a bunch of strangers cheering in surprise that you are not dead. They put us on a chartered flight back to New York. If you've never been on a chartered flight full of people who are afraid to fly, who have also been traumatized in the past 12 hours, I recommend it more than a cruise. It's pretty funny. Everyone is jittery, and when the pilot makes the unfortunate choice of testing the PA system by saying, "Bravo, bravo," you can almost hear people's beeholes tighten. A collective cartoon mouse squeak of beehole. What if I told you now that the plane crashed while taxiing on the runway? It didn't. We made it home. Shaken but tan. The most interesting thing I learned from this trip came when I told the story to my friend James, who had been a performer on cruise ships years before. When I told him the woman said, "Bravo, bravo, bravo," James froze. Did she really say it three times? He needed to know. Then James laid it out for me. Bravo is serious. The more times they say it, the more serious it is. The most times they ever say it is four times, and if they say it four times, it means you are going down to your watery grave. So, bravo, bravo, bravo was not terrific. Interesting fact number two, in the event of an emergency, it is the entertainers who are in charge of the lifeboats. Because the rest of the crew have actual nautical duties, the kids from Fiesta Caliente are trained to man the lifeboats. If you ever have to get on a lifeboat, the person in charge of your safety will likely be a 19-year-old dancer from Tampa who just had a fight with his boyfriend about the new Rihanna video. James also told me that each lifeboat has a gun on it, and that once a lifeboat is in the water, the performer slash lifeboat captain is trained to shoot anyone who is disruptive. This is apparently illegal in accordance with maritime law. About a week later, we get a letter of apology in the mail offering us a free cruise of equal or lesser value as compensation. This offer is non-transferable. I'm pretty sure the only people who took that offer were the drunk guy next door, his stripper wife, and those dicks from Table 20. But I shall not cruise again. Luxury cruises were designed to make something unbearable, a two-week transatlantic crossing, seem bearable. There's no need to do it now. There are planes. You wouldn't take a vacation where you ride on a stagecoach for 2 months, but there's all-you-can-eat shrimp. You wouldn't take a vacation where you had an old-timey appendectomy without anesthesia while steel drums play. You might take a vacation where you ride on a camel for 2 days, if they gave you those little animal towels wearing your sunglasses. What were you thinking when we were holding hands diagonally, I ask. Jeff says, I was thinking, it's going to be so hard for her when she chooses not to get on that lifeboat and stay with me. Oof. I decide I can't start this marriage with a lie. Really? I say. Because I was thinking it was going to be so hard for you when I got on the lifeboat and you had to stay behind. He is appalled. I plead my case. Remember when we saw Titanic, how mad I was at Kate Winslet when she climbed out of the lifeboat and back onto the ship? I think she encumbered Leonardo DiCaprio. If she had gone on the lifeboat, then he could have had that piece of wood she was floating on and they both would have survived. I would never do that to you. I wait for his response, hoping that in the 21st century, romantic love can be defined as not lying about your plans to get on the lifeboat and remembering to get your partner some pills. He just laughs. With that settled, we begin our married life. The Secrets of Mommy's Beauty. I know why you bought this audiobook, or should I say, I know why you borrowed this audiobook from that woman in your office. You want to know my secret beauty regimen. I learned early on that a woman must master and protect the secrets of her beauty, but I will share with you my 12 tenets of looking amazing forever. 1. Form good beauty habits early. How do you stay so eternally youthful? Your skin is so flawless. What's your secret? People always ask Sharon Stone. Like my peer Sharon Stone, I have always felt that the simplest products are the best. Sharon credits her good skin to Pond's cold cream, and maybe a little bit of nature's own botulism. Wink! In my youth, I washed daily with Ivory soap and Prel shampoo. Everyone knew Prel was the best shampoo because you could also use it to clean a frying pan. I then dried my hair with a hot comb. The hot comb was a small, vibrating, wheezing hairbrush that for some reason my family kept in the dining room credenza. Maybe it wanted to be close to the electric knife, since they were almost the exact same machine. If I didn't have time for the full hot comb treatment, for example, if I was in a hurry to get outside and choreograph a pretend Pepsi commercial with my friend Maureen, I would stand in front of our giant air conditioner and let it blast my hair dry. 2. The right undergarments are an essential part of your silhouette. I developed breasts very early, around 9 years old. I developed breasts so weird and high, it's possible they were above my collarbone. At that point, wearing a bra was not so much about holding the breasts up as clarifying that they were not a goiter. My mother knew the importance of getting the right fit for a bra, so she took me to JCPenney and tried one on over my clothes. She tried a bra on me over my clothes in the middle of JCPenney. I thank her for this. This early breast-related humiliation prevented me from ever needing to participate in Girls Gone Wild in my 20s. Number 3. Skincare, skincare, skincare. Makeup companies like to make skincare seem complicated, but let me demystify it for you. The 3 secrets of great skincare are moisture, S-O-O-T-S, stay out of the sun, and be Italian. The 3 rules of S-O-O-T-S are sunscreen, A-W-A-H, always wear a hat, and D-L-O, don't lay out. Don't lay out is a mnemonic device for do lots of omega-3s, which can be found in swabs, salmon, walnuts, and weird bread. Consistency is the most important part of skincare, followed by water drinking, and both of those are less important than S-L-E-E-P, sleep like everyone else, please. At the tender age of 14, I was already invigorating my skin with a rigorous daily massage. I squeezed and picked at every pore, harvesting any and all goo balls. This, followed by a bracing splash of sea breeze, has helped keep my pores large and supple to this day. By 19, I had discovered that Retin-A was a great way to have large chunks of your skin peel off and waft to the floor during acting class. Yes, I have actually taken several acting classes. 4. Don't be afraid to try outside-the-box skincare solutions. I spent most of 1990 bargaining with God that I would take one gigantic lifelong back zit in exchange for clear skin on my face. While this never worked out, I do not at all regret the time I spent pursuing it. It's about the journey, people. 5. The eyes are the window to where the soul is supposed to be. I taught Monica Lewinsky everything she knows about eye cream. I guess I should back up and explain that. In the spring of 1999, I participated in a secret meeting with Monica Lewinsky, SNL producer Marcy Klein, and fellow SNL writer Paula Pell. Marcy called and asked how quickly Paula and I could get down to her Tribeca apartment. Monica Lewinsky was coming over, and we 3 were going to convince her to appear on SNL. This was before Ms. Lewinsky's infamous Barbara Walters interview aired. None of us had even heard her speak before. She was still that enigmatic girl in the beret who didn't get to the dry cleaners very often. We spent the afternoon drinking wine and eating wasabi peas. We didn't even buy the girl lunch. Who did we think we were, presidents? Monica was bright and personable and very open with us. Maybe a little too open for a person in her situation. I'm just saying, Linda Tripp might not have been the intelligence-gathering mastermind you thought she was. We talked about thongs, Weight Watchers, and Brazilian bikini waxes, but you probably knew all that when I said it was 1999. When the topic turned to eye cream, I wanted to talk, so I shared the one piece of information I'd retained from the mean woman at the La Mer counter in Saks. You're supposed to gently pat it on with your ring finger, I demonstrated. Oh, really? Monica asked with a level of interest and gullibility that explained a lot. To this day, I think of Monica whenever I apply my eye cream, and I'm sure she thinks of me. 6. Space lasers. As you age, you may want to pay someone to shoot lasers at your face. If you are a fancy lady and live in a fancy urban center like New York or Dallas-Fort Worth, you can go to a fancy dermatologist, and they cover your eyes and point various machines at your face to promote collagen production. If you live far from a city, you can simulate the experience at home by having a friend hide your wallet while you sit close to a space heater. It will work just as well. For a while, I was getting my laser money removal done by a fancy doctor on Park Avenue. One day, I went to see about some hormonal acne that wouldn't go away on my jawline. The doctor eagerly injected the spot with steroids, and within a day or two, the blemish had shrunk down to normal. Unfortunately, the steroids caused the spot to keep shrinking, and by the end of the week, I had a divot in my jaw through which I could feel the bone. I was furious and complaining about it in the makeup chair at SNL. My face is already pretty banged up, and now I have another scar to deal with? Amy Poehler called to me from across the room. The difference is, now you're paying for it. She was right. I really had made it. We high-fived about it later. 7. A woman's hair is her crowning glory, the guys who wrote the Bible. Beauty experts in the 1970s declared the shag the most universally flattering haircut. The short layers in the front framed the face, while irregular, longer pieces in the back elongated the neck. I think the picture in your PDF proves them right. Finding a hairstylist you trust is key. For many years, I worked exclusively with the students at the Gordon Phillips Beauty Academy. The sign out front said it all. Gordon Phillips Beauty Academy, London, Paris, Upper Derby. Always on the cutting edge of beauty, I believe the haircut you see in your PDF was executed by folding my face in half and cutting out a heart. Of course, I must be honest. This is clearly a professional photo taken on picture day. I didn't look this sleek and pulled together all the time. 8. Question. But Tina, most of us don't have constant access to a hairstylist. What do we do? Answer. First of all, don't speak to me in that tone. Second of all, you must learn to tame your own mane. I first found a system that worked for me in the mid-80s. Once or twice a week, I would set my alarm for 6 a.m. so I could get up and plug in the hot sticks. Hot sticks were heated rubber sticks, and you would twist your hair around them and then roll it up. After about 15 minutes, you took all the sticks out, and your hair was curled up in tight rings with dry, raggedy ends. I would study the curls in the mirror, impressed with both the appliance and my newfound ability to use it. Then, without fail, at the last second before leaving for school, I would ask myself, am I supposed to brush it out or leave it? Why could I never remember? That feeling of, I'm pretty sure this next step is wrong, but I'm just going to do it anyway, is part of the same instincts that make me such a great cook. On some level, I knew I wasn't supposed to brush it out, but I couldn't stop myself, my hand gripping the brush like it was a hand transplant from a murderer who hated beauty, brushed through the curls, turning them into a giant, static-filled mess. By the end of homeroom, it was pulled into a ponytail, which really works on me, so there you have it. Right after I graduated high school, I decided to cut my hair off. This was my chance to reinvent myself before college. After a harsh disagreement over the ideational hollowness of sausage curls, my mother and I had ended our artistic experiment with the Gordon Phillips Academy. We were now getting our hair cut by my classmate's mom, who was also a professional Ann Gillian lookalike. Yes, the feeling you're experiencing right now is jealousy. The whole family was glamorous that way. I always envied their lives because they seemed like they were living in a sitcom. They were all blonde and good-looking. The mom cut hair out of her basement salon and Ann Gillian'd part-time. You could sell this show to CBS just with that. The dad ran a restaurant. The uncle was our school's cool English teacher. The oldest son was a Bon Jovi type who was the star of our high school choir and went all the way to New York once a week for private hard rock vocal coaching. The middle son was a brilliant, funny, cuddly giant who drew sardonic cartoons in the margins of things, and the baby of the family was the Jason Priestley-level adorable kid who clearly the producers of the family had added in the last season to boost ratings. I mean, just looking at this family, you knew they were going to make it to syndication. It was natural that I would trust Mrs. Doyle to transform me into my new college self. I wanted to cut it all off. Not the coward's move, not a bob. The full choppery. Mrs. Doyle pulled my hair into a thick ponytail, cut that ponytail off, and handed it to me. I still have it somewhere in a cardboard box in my parents' house. I know because my mom has been politely asking me to maybe spend an hour going through those boxes for over 20 years now. The haircut was cropped close on the sides, fuller on top, with two long Liza Minnelli-esque wisps that hung down like payas. I loved it. Then I asked whether we needed the wisps, but once it was explained to me that they were mandatory, I went back to loving it. Nerd no more. This new cut let people see the real me that was inside. A mother of four who was somehow also a virgin. 9. When it comes to fashion, find what works for you and stick with it. A wise friend once told me, don't wear what fashion designers tell you to wear. Wear what they wear. His point being that most designers, no matter what they throw onto the runway, favor simple, flattering pieces for themselves. Anyone who has never met me can tell you that fashion has always been very, 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 very important to me. For example, I once told my cousin that my dream would be if the whole store Express was my closet. How prescient, because now, of course, I wear nothing but Express. It can't be said enough. Don't concern yourself with fashion. Stick to simple pieces that flatter your body type. By 19, I had found my look. Oversized t-shirts, bike shorts, and wrestling shoes. To prevent the silhouette from being too baggy, I would cinch it at the waist with my fanny pack. I was pretty sure I would wear this look forever. The shirts allowed me to express myself with cool sayings like, "There's no crying in baseball," and "Universität Heidelberg." The bike shorts showed off my muscular legs, and the fanny pack held all my trolley tokens. I was nailing it on a daily basis. Find something like this for yourself as soon as possible. 10. A manicure is a must. Once I moved to New York City in 1997, I discovered the joys of the quickie Korean manicure. The city is filled with tiny storefront nail salons where you can get a manicure pedicure, an underarm wax, and a 10-minute series of punches in the back, all for under $100. The first few times you go, it can be intimidating. For starters, you may forget that you yourself speak English. You enter, smile, and nod at the manager. Manicure pedicure? Pick color, she chirps back in her Korean accent. You pick out a couple of the 300 shades of off-white. This for manicure, this feet, magazine okay? Why are you talking like that? Now that you've racially embarrassed yourself, you are ready to squeeze into a seat at a tiny table and basically hold hands with a stranger for 20 minutes. That really is the craziest thing the first few times you go, getting used to passively flopping your hands into another woman's hands. It's like something they'd make you do at summer camp as a trust-building exercise, I assume. I never went to summer camp as I was neither underprivileged nor Jewish nor extremely Christian nor obese. It would be a great exercise for someone who thinks they want to move to New York. Sit in an enclosed space full of fumes and hold hands with a stranger for 20 minutes while everyone around you speaks a language you don't understand. If you enjoy this, you will enjoy the 6 train. To take your mind off how weird it is to have someone else clean your fingers, there is a series of theatrical performances all around you. To your right, you might find a New Yorker speaking animatedly about an apartment she has seen. Ugh, it was sick. You don't even know. Marble slabs. The more New Yorkers like something, the more disgusted they are. The kitchen was all sub-zero. I want to kill myself. The building has a playroom that makes you want to break your own jaw with a golf club. I can't take it. To your left may sit an older woman eating cashews with one hand while talking on the phone with the other while still receiving a manicure and oversharing. I know. I was crying about it on the toilet this morning. Don't cut the cuticles, please. As you listen closer, you will suspect that she is participating in a paid therapy session over the phone. Well, you know, it's about setting boundaries. He has to be told if we're going to have these conversations, it shouldn't be when one of us is drunk and the other one is hanging upside down in the gravity boots. As you listen longer, you're not sure if she's the patient or the therapist. Do I think it's good that you're angry? Why would I think it's good that you're angry? There are never fewer than 8 Tracy Ullman characters in any New York City nail salon at any given time. If all this becomes too much for you, just look up and focus on the poster of a hand with long red nails holding a violin incorrectly. Before you know it, your manicure is done and looking great. Your fingernails look healthy and fresh, and the shiny varnish will help hide the little particles of garbage and human feces that all city dwellers are slightly covered in. 11. Aging naturally, without looking like time-lapse photography of a rotting sparrow. At a certain point, your body wants to be disgusting. While your teens and 20s were about identifying and emphasizing your best features, your late 30s and 40s are about fighting back decay. You pluck your patchy beard daily. Your big toe may start to turn jauntily inward. Overnight, you may grow one long, straight, white pubic hair. Not that this has happened to me, of course, because every 6 months I get a very expensive Japanese treatment that turns my pubic hair clear like rice noodles. We all mentally prepare ourselves for wrinkles, but wrinkles are not the problem. It's the unexpected groceries. For example, your mouth. Dear God, your mouth. No matter how diligent you are about brushing and flossing, which is never diligent enough for that show-off dental hygienist of yours, at some point you start waking up every day with a mouth that smells like a snail left in the sun. You can fix it as soon as you get up. You brush and use mouthwash, but there's something about knowing you woke up with hot mothball mouth that makes you feel old. I think God designed our mouths to die first to help us slowly transition to the grave. But I'm a big believer in intelligent design, and by that I mean I love IKEA. 12. The most important rule of beauty. If you retain nothing else, always remember the most important rule of beauty, which is, who cares? Remembrances of being very, very skinny. For a brief time, at the turn of the century, I was very skinny. This is what I remember about that period. I was cold all the time. I had a pair of size 4 corduroy short shorts that I wore to work in the middle of Manhattan. I loved it when people told me I was getting too thin. I once took a bag of sliced red peppers to the beach as a snack. I regularly ate health food cookies so disgusting that when I enthusiastically gave one to Rachel Dratch, she drew a picture of a rabbit and broke the cookie into a trail of tiny pieces coming out of the rabbit's butt. Men I had met before suddenly paid attention to me, and I hated them for it. Sometimes I had to sleep with a pillow between my legs because my bony knees clanking together kept me awake. I had a lot of time on my hands because I wasn't constantly eating. I ran 3 miles a day on a treadmill 6 days a week. I felt wonderfully superior to everyone. I didn't have a kid yet. We should leave people alone about their weight. Being skinny for a while, provided you actually eat food and don't take pills or smoke to get there, is a perfectly fine pastime. Everyone should try it once, like a super short haircut or dating a white guy. Remembrances of being a little bit fat. For a brief time, at the end of the last century, I was overweight. This is what I remember about that period. My boobs were bigger. I once left a restaurant in the middle of dessert to get to Krispy Kreme before it closed. Even though I only liked McDonald's fries, I believed it was more nutritious to make a meal of it and have 2 cheeseburgers as well. If I was really ambitious, I would get a Whopper Jr. at Burger King and then walk to McDonald's to get the fries. The shake could be from anywhere. I could not run a mile. I wore oversized men's overalls that I loved. Guys who were friends with me did not want to date me, and I hated them for it. On at least 3 occasions, I threw up on Christmas Eve from mixing chocolate, peel-and-eat shrimp, summer sausage, and cheese. No alcohol was involved. As a size 12, I took pride in the idea that I was real woman-sized. Size 12 is the national average, I would boast, no matter what magazines try to tell you. Once, while ironing in my underwear, I grazed my protruding belly with the hot iron. We should leave people alone about their weight. Being chubby for a while, provided you don't give yourself diabetes, is a natural phase of life and nothing to be ashamed of, like puberty or slowly turning into a Republican. A childhood dream realized, not the one where I'm being chased by Count Chocula. In 1997, I flew to New York from Chicago to interview for a writing position at Saturday Night Live. It seemed promising because I'd heard the show was looking to diversify. Only in comedy, by the way, does an obedient white girl from the suburbs count as diversity. I came for the job interview in the only decent clothes I had, my show clothes from the Second City, black pants and a lavender chenille sweater from Contempo Casuals. I went to the security guard at the elevator and I heard myself say, "I'm here to see Lorne Michaels." I couldn't believe the words that were coming out of my mouth. "I'm here to see Lorne Michaels." I was living one of my dreams. This must be how people feel when they really do go to school naked by accident. I went up to the 17th floor offices, which were lined with archival photos from the show. Jane Curtin ripping her shirt open on Weekend Update. Gilda Radner and Candace Bergen in a beach blanket bingo sketch. Al Franken's headshot. Then I sat on a couch and waited for my meeting with Lorne. About an hour into the wait, the assistant started making popcorn in a movie theater popcorn machine, something I would later learn signaled Lorne's imminent arrival. To this day, the smell of fresh popcorn causes me to experience stress, hunger, and sketch ideas for John Goodman. The only advice anyone had given me about meeting with Lorne was, "Whatever you do, don't finish his sentences." A Chicago actress I knew had apparently made that mistake, and she believed it cost her the job. When I was eventually ushered into his office, I sat down, determined not to blow it. Lorne said, "So, you're from..." It seemed to hang there forever. Why wasn't he finishing the question? If I answered now, would this count as my talking over him? I couldn't remember how normal human speech patterns worked. Another 5 seconds went by, and still no more sentence from Lorne. Oh, God. When I flew back to Chicago the next day, they were going to say, "How was your meeting with Lorne Michaels?" And I would reply, "He said, 'So you're from...'" And then we sat there for an hour, and then a girl came in and asked me to leave. After what was probably, realistically, 10 seconds, I couldn't take it anymore, and I blurted out, "Pennsylvania, I'm from Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia." Just as Lorne finally finished his thought,
Chicago?
I was sure I had blown it. I don't remember anything else that happened in that meeting because I just kept staring at the nameplate on his desk that said Lorne Michaels and thinking, this is the guy with the Beatles check. I couldn't believe I was in his office. I could never have guessed that in a few years I'd be sitting in that office at 2, 3, 4 in the morning thinking, if this meeting doesn't end soon, I'm going to kill this Canadian bastard. Somehow, I had gotten the job. During my 9 years at Saturday Night Live, my relationship with Lorne transitioned from terrified pupil and reluctant teacher to small-town girl and streetwise madam showing her the ropes, to Annie and Daddy Warbucks touring company, to one of mutual respect and friendship. Then it transitioned to sullen teenage girl and generous stepfather, then to Mr. and Mrs. Michael Jackson, then for a brief period to boy who doesn't believe in Christmas and recluse neighbor who proves that miracles are possible, then back to mutual respect and friendship again. I've learned many things from Lorne, in particular, a managerial style that was the opposite of bossy pants. Things I learned from Lorne Michaels. 1. Producing is about discouraging creativity. A TV show comprises many departments, costumes, props, talent, graphics, set dressing, transportation. Everyone in every department wants to show off their skills and contribute creatively to the show, which is a blessing. You're grateful to work with people who are talented and enthusiastic about their jobs. You would think that as a producer, your job would be to churn up creativity, but mostly your job is to police enthusiasm. You may have an occasion where the script calls for a bran muffin on a white plate, and then the props department shows up with a bran cake in the shape of Santa Claus sitting on a silver tray that says, "Welcome to Denmark." "We just thought it would be funny," they say. And you have to find a polite way to explain that, well, the character is Jewish, so her eating Santa's face might have negative connotations, and the silver tray, while beautiful, is giving a weird glare on camera, so maybe, yeah, you know, let's just go with a bran muffin on the white plate. And then sometimes actors have what they call ideas. Usually it involves them talking more, or in the case of more experienced actors, sitting more. When actors have ideas, it's very important to get to the core reason behind their idea. Is there something you're asking them to do that's making them uncomfortable? Are they being asked to bare their midriff or make out with a Dick Cheney lookalike? For the record, I have asked actors to do both and they were completely game. Rather than say, "I'm uncomfortable breastfeeding a grown man I just met today," the actor may speak in code and say something like, "I don't think my character would do that," or, "I've hurt my back and I'm not coming out of my dressing room." You have to remember that actors are human beings, which is hard sometimes because they look so much better than human beings. Is there someone in the room the actor is trying to impress? This is a big one and should not be overlooked. If a male actor is giving you a hard time about something, you must immediately scan the area for pretty interns. 2. The show does not go on because it's ready. It goes on because it's 11:30. This is something Lorne has said often about Saturday Night Live, but I think it's a great lesson about not being too precious about your writing. You have to try your hardest to be at the top of your game and improve every joke you can to the last possible second, and then you have to let it go. You can't be that kid at the top of the water slide overthinking it. You have to just go down the chute. And I'm from a generation where a lot of people died on water slides, so this was an important lesson for me to learn. You have to let people see what you wrote. It will never be perfect, but perfect is overrated. Perfect is boring on live TV. What I learned about bombing as an improviser at Second City was that bombing is painful, but it doesn't kill you. No matter how badly an improv set goes, you will still be physically alive when it's over. What I learned about bombing as a writer at Saturday Night is that you can't be too worried about your permanent record. Yes, you're going to write some sketches that you love and are proud of forever, your golden nuggets, but you're also going to write some real shit nuggets. And unfortunately, sometimes the shit nuggets will make it onto the air. You can't worry about it. As long as you know the difference, you can go back to panning for gold on Monday. That's what's so great about Will Ferrell. He would do sketches that were absolutely his voice and what I assume he loved most, Bill Brasky, Robert Goulet, and Cowbell. But he would commit just as fully to tap dancing next to Katie Holmes in the monologue. He's the Michael Caine of sketch comedy. He could be in something awful and it would never stick to him. 3. When hiring, mix Harvard nerds with Chicago improvisers and stir. The writing staff of Saturday Night Live has always been a mix of hyper-intelligent Harvard boys. I say Harvard boys because they are almost always male, but not exclusively. Rock on, Amy Ozzles. And because they are usually under 25 and have never done physical labor with their arms or legs. I love them very much. Anyway, the writers at SNL are a mix of hyper-intelligent Harvard boys, Jim Downey, Al Franken, Conan O'Brien, and gifted, visceral, fun performers, John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Jan Hooks, Horatio Sanz, Bill Murray, Maya Rudolph. Lorne somehow knew that too many of one or the other would knock the show out of balance. To generalize with abandon, if you had nothing but Harvard guys, the whole show would be commercial parodies about people wearing barrels after the 1929 stock market crash. Flenderson's Poverty Barrels, a semiotic representation of financial ruin since right now. Formerly known as Flenderson's The Jazz Age Is Going to Last Forever brand pickles. If you had nothing but improvisers, the whole show would be loud drag characters named Vicky and Stacy screaming their catchphrase over and over. You kiss your mother with that face? Harvard boys and improv people think differently because their comedy upbringing is so different. If you're at the Harvard Lampoon, sitting in a castle with your friends, you can perfect a piece of writing to be exactly what you want, and you can avoid the red-hot feeling of flop sweat, especially because you won't be there when someone reads it. But when you're improvising 8 shows a week in front of drunk, meat-eating Chicagoans, you will experience highs and lows. You will be heckled, or worse, you will hear your own heartbeat over the audience's silence. You will be bombing so hard that you will be able to hear a lady in the back put her gum in a napkin. You may have a point to make about the healthcare system in America, but you'll find out that you need to present that idea through a legally blind bus driver character, or as an exotic dancer whose boobs are running for mayor. I would like to see that sketch, actually. Ultimately, you will do whatever it takes to win that audience over. Harvard is classical military theory, improv is Vietnam. This is all to make the case that Harvard boys and Second City slash Groundlings people make beautiful comedy marriages. The Harvard guys keep the improvisers from wallowing in schmaltz. Steve Higgins used to joke that every Second City sketch ended with sentimental music and someone saying, "I love you, Dad." The Harvard guys check the logic and construction of every joke, and the improvisers teach them how to be human. It's Spock and Kirk. I guess if you want to tie all my metaphors together, it would be Spock wearing a baldric and staying up all night to write a talk show sketch with a mentally ravaged Rambo Kirk. I tried to apply Lorne's lesson when staffing 30 Rock, and it has worked well so far. Our current staff makeup is 4 Harvard nerds, 4 performer-turned-writers, 2 regular nerds, and 2 dirtbags. 4. Television is a visual medium. Lorne has said this to me a lot. It basically means, go to bed, you look tired. You may want to be diligent and stay up with the writers all night, but if you're going to be on the show, you can't. Your street cred with the staff won't help anybody if you look like a cadaver on camera. Also, don't be afraid to make them get your hair, makeup, and lighting right. It's not vanity, because if you look weird, it will distract from what you're trying to do. If you look as good as you can, people will be able to pay attention to what you're actually saying. 5. Don't make any big decisions right after the season ends. This is the same advice they give people who've just come out of rehab. After a grueling period of work, or what passes for grueling work in our soft-handed world, you will crave some kind of reward. Don't let this cause you to rush into a big decision like a new house or a marriage or partial ownership of a minor league baseball team that you may later regret. The interesting thing about this piece of advice is that no one ever takes it. 6. Never cut to a closed door. Lorne sighed this once in exasperation over some sketch I can't remember. The director had cut to a door a moment too early before the actor entered, and Lorne felt that we lost the audience in that moment. This can mean a lot of things. Comedy is about confidence, and the moment an audience senses a slip in confidence, they're nervous for you and they can't laugh. Lorne would have preferred that the camera cut followed the sound of the actor knocking on the door, which is to say that the sketch should lead the cutting pattern, which is to say content should dictate style, which is to say that in TV, the writer is king. In its most extrapolated version, I think, never cut to a closed door means don't forget about showmanship. Make the entrance well-timed and exciting. Make the set look pretty at Christmas time. Add some dancers. There's no harm in things looking fun, and you don't get extra credit for keeping things indie and grim. Or, and this is a distinct possibility, it doesn't mean anything and he was just in a grouchy mood. 7. Don't hire anyone that you wouldn't want to see in the hallway at 3 in the morning. This one is incredibly helpful. We work long hours at these shows, and no matter how funny someone's writing sample is, if they are too talkative or needy or angry to deal with in the middle of the night by the printer, steer clear. That must be how I got through the first job interview. I was not dynamic, but at least I wasn't nuts. 8. Never tell a crazy person he's crazy. While never overtly stated, this seemed to be Lorne's practice. There were many times in my 9 years at the show where I couldn't understand why Lorne wouldn't just tell people to knock it off. Eccentric writers would turn in sketches that were 17 minutes long. Immature performers tried fits and tears when their sketch was later in the show than they'd like. My every terrible instinct would have been to pull these culprits aside and scold them like a schoolmarm. Please explain to me why your sketch should get to be 3 times longer than everyone else's. Why won't you take the perfectly reasonable cuts I suggested? How dare you pitch a fit about what time your sketch is on? Some people didn't get to be in the show at all. Do you think you're working harder than everyone else? We're all working hard. But there is not one management course in the world where they recommend self-righteousness as a tool. Lorne is an indirect and very effective way of dealing with the crazies. It is best described by the old joke that most people know from Annie Hall. A man goes to a psychiatrist and says, "My brother's gone crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." And the psychiatrist says, "Have you told him he's not a chicken?" And the man replies, "I would, but we need the eggs." Lorne knows that the most exhausting people occasionally turn out the best stuff. How do I explain the presence of crazy people on the staff if we're following rule number 7? Easily. These crazy people are charming and brilliant and great fun to see at 3 in the morning. Also, some people arrive at the show sane and the show turns them crazy. In fairness to others, I will use myself as an example. In October 2001, Manhattan was a tense place to work. But we all continued to work because it seemed like the Churchillian thing to do. One Friday morning, I was sitting in my tiny dressing room at 30 Rockefeller Plaza trying to write jokes for Weekend Update. I was reading a thick packet of newspaper clippings looking for something fun to say about Afghanistan, the Taliban, Saddam Hussein, the anthrax postal deaths. It was grim. Then, on the TV hanging in the corner, Lester Holt came on MSNBC and said, "Breaking news, anthrax has been found at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. CDC officials are investigating the potentially deadly substance, which was found in a suspicious package addressed to NBC Nightly News anchor Tom Brokaw and mailed to his office in 30 Rockefeller Plaza." If you have decent listening comprehension skills, you will remember from the beginning of this paragraph that I, too, was at 30 Rockefeller Anthrax Plaza. Not 45 Rockefeller Plaza. Not 1661 6th Avenue. 30 Rockefeller Plaza. Nope, I thought. I give up. I put on my coat, walked downstairs past my friends and co-workers without saying anything. I walked right past the host for that week, sweet Drew Barrymore, without telling her what I had heard. I just went to the elevator and left. I walked up 6th Avenue to Central Park West. I walked up Central Park West to 96th Street and across 96th Street to my apartment on West End Avenue where I would wait to die. Several hours later, Lorne called and said gently, "We're all here. You and Drew are the only ones who left, and Drew came back a few hours ago, so we're ordering dinner if you want to come back in." It was the most gentle, non-bossy pants way of saying, "You're embarrassing yourself." I got back to work that evening just in time to find everyone assembled on the studio floor. Andy Lack, the head of NBC News, was addressing the crew in an emergency briefing. Once again, nothing is creepier than a bunch of adults being very quiet. Mr. Lack explained that the envelope was found on the 3rd floor NBC News offices, so the CDC would be swabbing workers from the 2nd floor to the 6th floor just to be safe. Remember all those fun catchphrases from 2001? Swabbing, cutaneous, Cipro, I am Zoolander. Some of our camera guys were irate that we on the 8th floor would not be swabbed. They occasionally filled in down in news. The discussion got heated. As I watched from the audience balcony, I remember feeling tremendous affection for everyone there. I felt like we were a family, and that if we had to go, at least we'd all go together. I guess I forgot that just a few hours earlier I had booked it out of there, leaving them all to die. I have a uniquely German capacity to vacillate between sentimentality and coldness. The point is, Lorne did not do what I would have done, which is to say, "You're being crazy. Get back here. Everyone else is here. Do you think you're more important than everyone else?" He also didn't coddle me, which is what I would have done if I were trying to overcompensate for my natural sternness. "Are you okay? If you need to take a couple of days off, I'm sure we can manage, blah, 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 blah." Instead, he found a way for me to slip back in the door like my mental breakdown never happened. "We're ordering dinner. What do you want?" He knew how to get the eggs. Peeing in jars with boys. My first show as a writer at Saturday Night Live was September 27th, 1997. The host was Sylvester Stallone. It was the first time I had ever seen a real movie star up close. Real movie stars do look different from regular people. They are often a little smaller and usually have nicer teeth, shoes, and watches than anyone else in the room. Mr. Stallone smoked a cigar during the host meeting, which was pretty badass. I don't remember what sketch ideas I pitched in that first meeting, but I know that on that first writing night, I completely froze up. I sat at my computer from 1 p.m. on Tuesday afternoon until 9 a.m. Wednesday morning, and nothing came out. I wasn't used to sitting by myself and writing. I'd been improvising with five other people every night for 2 years. I ended up submitting an old sketch that I had written as part of my job application. Needless to say, my sketch didn't get picked for the show, but I was assigned to help cover a sketch that Sherry O'Terry had written with another writer. Writers are often assigned to help produce sketches that the performers write. I followed Sherry and writer Scott Wanio around through rehearsal, occasionally pitching jokes for the sketch that were rightfully ignored. During the dress rehearsal, Lorne gave us the note that he couldn't understand Stallone in the sketch, and we should ask him to enunciate more. I stood nervously outside the host's dressing room with Scott Wanio. He had been there a year already, so I figured he'd know what to do. Scott's experience level was evident when he looked at me and shrugged. "You tell him." My trademark obedience kicked in, and I found myself knocking on the door and being ushered in. Judge Dredd himself was on the couch in an undershirt smoking another cigar. He looked up at me. I muttered, "In the Rita sketch, you're a little hard to understand. If you could just, like, enunciate a little more." Stallone was unfazed.
"You can't understand me? You name it and enunciate more? Okay."
It's an amazing Stallone impression, by the way. He couldn't have been more easygoing about it. My guess is this was not the first time in his career he had been given that note. I went back outside and manually released my butt cheeks. Over the years, I came to realize that the movie star hosts of the show were just people who wanted to do a good job, and with the exception of a very small handful of D-bags, they were eager for any guidance. Who were the D-bags, you ask? I couldn't possibly tell you. But if you want to figure it out, here's a clue. The letters from their names are sprinkled randomly throughout this chapter. The only other thing I remember about the Sylvester Stallone show was that they did a Rocky-themed monologue, and they needed somebody to play Rocky's wife, Adrian. Sherry really wanted the part. She was little, she was from Philly, she could do a good imitation of Talia Shire, but instead, somebody thought it would be funnier to put Chris Kattan in a dress. I remember thinking that was kind of bullshit. I wasn't privy to the decision-making process at the time. It was my first week, after all. When I reminded producer Steve Higgins of it recently, he understandably couldn't remember whose idea it was and thought that it may have even have been Sylvester Stallone's idea. No offense to Kattan, whom I love, or to Sylvester Stallone, but I think Sherry would have been funnier as Adrian. Now, an anecdote about somebody at the show being frustrated and feeling cheated is hardly worth mentioning. It happens to everyone, male or female, at some point every week. Saturday Night Live runs on a combustion engine of ambition and disappointment. But I tell this specific tale of Sherry being passed over for Kattan and drag because it illustrates how things were the first week I was there. By the time I left 9 years later, that would never have happened. Nobody would have thought for a second that a dude in drag would be funnier than Amy or Maya or Kristen. The women in the cast took over the show in that decade, and I had the pleasure of being there to witness it. An FAQ, freaking always asked question. People often ask me about the difference between male and female comedians. Do men and women find different things funny? I usually attempt an answer that is so diplomatic and boring that the person will just walk away. Something like, well, there's a tremendous amount of overlap in what men and women think are funny, and I hate to generalize, but I would say at the far ends of the spectrum, men may prefer visceral, absurd elements like sharks and robots, while women are more drawn to character-based jokes and verbal idiosyncrasies. Have you walked away yet? Here's the truth. There is an actual difference between male and female comedy writers, and I'm going to reveal it now. The men urinate in cups. And sometimes jars. One of the first times I walked into my old boss, Steve Higgins' office, he was eating an apple and smoking a cigarette at the same time. When I started at SNL, you could still smoke in an office building. I might not be young. I had only been there a few weeks, and Steve had been very encouraging and supportive. I forget what we were talking about, but I went to get a reference book off a high shelf in Steve's office. I reached to move the paper cup that was in front of it, and Higgins jumped up. Don't touch that. Hang on. He grabbed the cup and a couple others like it around the office and took them out of the room to dump them. Oh, yeah, that's pee in those cups, my friend Paula later informed me. I could not believe it. I had come from the Second City, which was by no means clean. It would not be unheard of to see a rat giving birth in an overstuffed ashtray, for example. But I had never heard of anyone peeing in a cup except at a doctor's office. Maybe you'd do it on a road trip if it was too far between rest stops. I had definitely never heard of anyone peeing in a cup and leaving it in his or her own office on a bookshelf to evaporate back into their body through the pores on their face. I told another male coworker about what I had seen. Was it not the grossest thing he had ever heard? He answered matter-of-factly that he occasionally did it too. Not all the time. He said it was just something guys did when they were too lazy to go to the bathroom. The bathroom, I should point out, was about as far away as you are from the device playing this audiobook. I started to feel like I was from space. I called Jeff back in Chicago. You grew up way out in the country with a bunch of brothers. Did you ever pee in cups and, like, leave them around? Jeff was incredulous. What? No, that's disgusting. 1,000 points for Jeff. Once I was aware of this practice, I started noticing the cups in other places. In the Weekend Update offices, which were like the smarter but meaner older brother of the regular writers' offices, there weren't any cups. There was a jar. It was a jar of piss with a lid on it, and judging by its consistency, I suspect they sometimes spat into the piss, or one of them was terribly ill. You could see it when you came in the door, backlit by the afternoon sun, and at first it seemed to me like a little test. If you saw the piss jar and dared to ignore it and continue into the room, you were welcomed. Welcomed is too strong a word. You were one of the guys. No, you know what? The more I think about it, I'm just projecting. It couldn't have been a test because they really didn't give a fuck whether you came in the room or not. And no, not all the men whizzed in cups, but 4 or 5 of them out of 20 did, so the men have to own that one. Anytime there's a bad female stand-up somewhere, some dickhead interblogger will deduce that women aren't funny. Using that same math, I can state male comedy writers piss in cups. Also, they like to pretend to rape each other. Don't worry about it. It's harmless, actually. So, to sum up my room-clearing generalizations, men are in comedy to break rules. Conversely, the women I know in comedy are all good daughters, good citizens, mild-mannered college graduates. Maybe we women gravitate toward comedy because it is a socially acceptable way to break rules and a release from our daily life. Have you left me for the cheese tray yet? Kotex Classic. This is the story of my proudest moment as one of the head writers of SNL. At the beginning of each season, the staff would write commercial parodies, the fake commercials that you have enjoyed over the past 35 years, such as Schmitz Gay and Colon Blow. I wish I wrote either of those, but I didn't. I did write Mom Jeans, Annual, and Excedrin for Racial Tension Headaches, if that helps. Each writer would submit 2 or 3 scripts, and the producers and head writers picked which commercials would be shot. We tried to choose carefully because, unlike live sketches, these commercials were shot on film in the days before HD video and could cost up to $100,000. It was a big deal to get your commercial parody made because they were permanent. They could repeat forever. Once again, this was in the days before YouTube, so reruns were meaningful and profitable. In a normal SNL show week, every sketch is read aloud by the cast at a table read in front of the whole staff. The room is packed with all the writers, designers, stage managers, musicians, etc., so you have a nice big audience. Everyone can hear where there are laughs, and everyone has a sense of what sketches would work. The commercial parodies didn't get that treatment, and choosing which ones to produce always brought out the worst in everyone. I would read the packet of 40 scripts and pick the ones I liked. Dennis McNicholas, the other head writer, would pick the ones he liked. Not surprisingly, we each strongly preferred the ones our friends wrote. There was an unspoken rule that you never pushed for your own piece, ever. Then we would each privately corner the producers, Steve Higgins and Tim Herlihy, and try to get them to agree with us. Higgins, Herlihy, Dennis, and I would continue this square dance of selling one another out for a week or so, only to find that Jim Signorelli, the colorful, long-standing director of these tape pieces, had started making whatever parody he liked without asking anyone, usually because it had high production values or a visual style he felt like shooting. It's a miracle anything ever got done. There was one parody script that I really fought for. It was back when classic was a big advertising trend. Coke Classic, Reebok Classic. The very, very funny Paula Pell had written a script called Kotex Classic. It was as if Kotex were trying to revive nostalgia for those old 1960s maxi pads that hooked to a belt. It featured the women in the cast enjoying fun, modern gal activities while giant sanitary napkins poked out of their low-rise jeans. It seemed to me like an excellent parody of nostalgia-based marketing while also being a little shocking and silly, which is great for an SNL commercial. I kept bringing it up in meetings only to be told that it would be too difficult to produce. Paula and I weren't sure what that meant, so we kept pressing. Finally, Steve Higgins and Jim Signorelli sat down with us and asked us to explain. How would we see it? Is it a thing that comes up the front? Would we have to zoom in on it? Wouldn't the girls have to take their pants off? Would we see blood? And this was what Oprah would call an aha moment for me, trademark Oprah Winfrey. They didn't know what a maxi pad belt was. It was the moment I realized there was no institutionalized sexism at that place. Sometimes they just literally didn't know what we were talking about. Just as I was not familiar with the completely normal custom of pissing in jars, they had never been handed a 15-year-old Kotex product by the school nurse. But they trusted me and Paula, so I'm proud to say we made her commercial, and the commercial worked. Two things were reassuring about this. One, that we were heard. Because Paula was such a goddamn hit factory, she wrote the cheerleaders, among other things, they were willing to trust us. And, more importantly, for all those years that I was sure that boys could tell when I had a loaf of bread-sized maxi pad going up the back of my pants, they actually had no idea. I don't care if you like it. One in a series of love letters to Amy Poehler. Amy Poehler was new to SNL, and we were all crowded into the 17th floor writer's room waiting for the Wednesday read-through to start. There were always a lot of noisy comedy bits going on in that room. Amy was in the middle of some such nonsense with Seth Meyers across the table, and she did something vulgar as a joke. I can't remember what it was exactly, except it was dirty and loud and unladylike. Jimmy Fallon, who was arguably the star of the show at that time, turned to her and, in a faux squeamish voice, said, "Oh, stop that! It's not cute! I don't like it!" Amy dropped what she was doing, went black in the eyes for a second, and wheeled around on him. "I don't fucking care if you like it!" Jimmy was visibly startled. Amy went right back to enjoying her ridiculous bit. I should make it clear that Jimmy and Amy are very good friends, and there was never any real beef between them. Insert penis joke here. With that exchange, a cosmic shift took place. Amy made it clear that she wasn't there to be cute. She wasn't there to play wives and girlfriends in the boys' scenes. She was there to do what she wanted to do, and she did not fucking care if you like it. I was so happy. Weirdly, I remember thinking, my friend is here. My friend is here. Even though things had been going great for me at the show, with Amy there, I felt less alone. I think of this whenever someone says to me, Jerry Lewis says women aren't funny, or Christopher Hitchens says women aren't funny, or Rick Fenderman says women aren't funny. Do you have anything to say to that? Yes, we don't fucking care if you like it. I don't say it out loud, of course, because Jerry Lewis is a great philanthropist. Hitchens is very sick, and the third guy I made up. Unless one of these men is my boss, which none of them is, it's irrelevant. My hat goes off to them. It is an impressively arrogant move to conclude that just because you don't like something, it is empirically not good. I don't like Chinese food, but I don't write articles trying to prove it doesn't exist. So, my unsolicited advice to women in the workplace is this. When faced with sexism, or ageism, or lookism, or even really aggressive Buddhism, ask yourself the following question. Is this person in between me and what I want to do? If the answer is no, ignore it and move on. Your energy is better used doing your work and outpacing people that way. Then, when you're in charge, don't